Welcome to another episode of Meenal's World. Thank you again for joining me this week. I've done a lot better this week in terms of planning and organizing. It's Tuesday night, so I'm doing a lot better than it was last week, as opposed to recording it on a Thursday night and trying to wrap things up just before midnight. I hope you're all doing really well, and I really hope you enjoyed the episode with Catherine Mayer last week. This week I have another fascinating conversation with Otto English, which is his author's name. His real name is Andrew Scott. Now, he's just released a book called Fake History, which I've read, and I think it's so, so important because, as I mentioned in the podcast, it gives us a lens into what the future can look like and also tells us what we've been through in our past as well and the lessons that we do need to learn moving forward, especially after what we've seen throughout the pandemic. But I won't spoil it too much. I'll let you guys dive straight into the conversation. But before I do that, please make sure that you do subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on iTunes if you can. It really does help reach out to more people. You can find this episode on my website as well, where I also have a newsletter that you can sign up to. So I won't plug in anything else, and I'll let you go straight into the show. Welcome to the show, Otto. Thank you for joining me today. And I know that we've been meaning to catch up for a while. I met you briefly a few months ago at the Byline Times meeting and gathering that we had. But it was so busy, we had to rush out because we have the little one at home. But it's so nice to finally sit down and have a chat with you.
Well, it's so nice to meet you as well. Properly, yeah.
I'll start off, Otto, with your book, because I just finished reading that and I've been, you know, dug into that the whole week. I found it really, really interesting because your book has come out, I would say, at the perfect time, especially during a time where we're living in a post-truth era. We don't know what's true, what isn't anymore. And to know that this has happened in the past was quite reassuring, because some part of me just thought that the world was pure evil. And like, all the news that we're seeing is just coming out of nowhere. But this has happened before. And your book has shined a light on so many important topics which have shaped, well, our history. So
yeah.
Your book has so much information. What was it like writing it and the research process behind it? Because, I mean, you seem to be an expert on almost everything.
Yes, well, I'm not an expert on everything. and I think it's really important to stress that. I deliberately picked a wide range of subjects because I didn't want the book just to be about the Second World War, Winston Churchill, or Anglo-centric things. I wanted it to have a broad remit and to cover lots and lots of different topics and areas. So some of those things, yes, I was knowledgeable about, and I've written about many times before. Some of those things were in my past life, because for the language stuff, for example, I was a language teacher, like many people who work in the theatre, as I did for a decade. You have to earn money and eat. So so many of us became language teachers. So I spent over a decade teaching people from a variety of backgrounds, cultures and things like that. And so the language stuff, I'm fascinated by language. So those things I knew. There were other elements that I was not so knowledgeable about, but I was determined to sort of push myself and almost take myself on a journey as well as the reader. The stuff about North Korea, for example, and Mongolia was relatively new to me. So I spent quite a long time researching that. And also, you can be a little bit lazy and just assume you know everything about Churchill. So I dug into Churchill's own writings. I'd seen the film of his early life as a child and seen it in adulthood as well. But I actually read those books and I've read his speeches and I went back in and sort of challenged myself. And so I found even the stuff I thought I knew, there was a lot of stuff that I was wrong about, which was worrying, really. Well, for example, during the rise of Boris Johnson, so in 2018, 2019, various outlets, so Politico, Byline, lots of people, I think at The Independent I wrote something as well. I wrote about Winston Churchill and the similarities between him and Boris Johnson. And I was quite dismissive. I said, you know, Winston was a much greater prime minister and things like that. As I researched, I realised there were a lot of parallels between Boris Johnson and Winston Churchill. Almost too many parallels between Boris Johnson and Winston Churchill. I don't know why I'm talking about Boris in the past tense, but they were both people who created a sort of caricature in order to sell themselves to the British public. They were both people who were frequently out of their depth. They were both people who were promoted beyond their ability into jobs, but kind of winged it and got away with it because they had this sort of charm and bluster and privilege, which people from that class tend to have, and that a sort of entitlement which allowed them to keep going where any normal sort of mortal, if you like, would probably stop, pause and think. So that was very interesting to me. And again, even the stuff around Dunkirk, I knew that the little ships had not entirely brought all of the people back, as we were led to believe in the films. But I had no idea of the extent of that deceit until I dug in. I was actually quite shocked by quite how much people believe that myth. In fact, my own publisher sent me an email whilst he was reading the first draft and went, "Are you absolutely sure this is right?" Which, and I was, but I sort of, you become slightly paranoid that you've got that even the things which are very well documented wrong, because the myth is so ingrained within us that it's hard to shift. So all of that stuff I thought was quite interesting to read, write about.
Otto, obviously you had to, I can't imagine how much you had to read and research, but how did you know what was factual and what wasn't? Like, what was your guiding force in that sense? Because as I said, we live in a post-truth time where we don't know what we're reading is true, and we don't know if our resources are the right ones. So how did you go about filtering
everything? So I did. I'm not a historian. I'm a writer and a journalist. So I did what writers and journalists do. I did what I do in my journalism. I dug into various sources and I did it that way. As I'm not a historian, I know a real historian would have gone to the brook, if you like, where the spring, where the river runs. I did a bit of that. I did a bit of that within what I could, because I approached the Imperial War Museum and I questioned one of their artifacts and had a correspondence with them. With the Chicken Tikka Masala story, I tracked down the guy who claims that he made that story up. I'm pretty sure he's telling the truth. But again, as I write elsewhere in the book, we all kind of tell myths about ourselves. So I think you have to, there's hard evidence, there's the paper trail of evidence, there's what really happened, there's the facts and figures. And the closer we are to those events, the easier those facts and figures are to trace. The further you go back, so the further you retreat back into the past and into different civilizations, as with, for example, Genghis Khan, the harder that paper trail becomes, because you have a much more limited number of sources. And again, as somebody who's done journalism for now a decade, I found that really interesting, actually, because yes, what are people relying on when there's very limited amounts of evidence? They are relying on other historians who might have been spinning their own saga. So you do have to be very, very aware of sources. Bede, on the other hand, the Venerable Bede, whose book I bought out of sort of a sense of duty to read, you know, that he was this cleric in the 9th century who's writing about early English history, so the few hundred years that have gone before. I found his book absolutely extraordinary, because there it spoke down the centuries. There was a man desperately trying to get his facts right. And you could see that he was getting his facts right. And the notes in my Oxford edition proved that he was getting his facts right with very limited resources. Sorry, I'll shut up.
This is really fascinating, Otto, because I've been reading up a lot about our systems and politics, but I only started to gain an interest in this last year when I went out to protest. I've said this before, Otto, I just went out to protest because I was angry. Like, there was nothing else behind it. It was just pure anger, pure frustration. And for example, now, if I go out and protest, I'll be going out with a completely different view. It wouldn't just be anger, but I would go out with a lot more knowledge because I've understood the realities of our systems now. And I think I would be 10 times more furious than I was last year because now I realize what's happening. And I think in the last year, as you just mentioned briefly before I hit record, that you're trying to sort of summarize the year, but what's happened in the last years, what you would in our history would usually happen in a decade or two decades. It brings me to the question, Otto, when did your fascination for history and fake news and actually, you know, bringing the truth out start? Because your background is, as you mentioned, you were in theatre before. So how did that transition happen?
It's quite interesting that there's quite a lot of, of the people I know who are doing similar things, like Peter Jukes, for example. Peter's background is in drama. And we live in very, very dramatic times. I can't speak for Peter Jakes, but for myself, I was sort of drawn to the human drama that was started really 2010 and social media. It almost became, I don't want to say it, an interactive experience, but it almost became like interactive drama. And we all got caught up in it. I think we were all people, well, certainly speaking for myself, I was driven by anger, just as you said about yourself, over Brexit in particular. And I was driven by a desire to get the facts right and for people to get the facts right. Going back to my own origin story, if you like, my childhood was in Essex, and I was one of those people who my father had me in his 50s. So I was when I was a small child, my father had fought in the Second World War. Most of my friends, it was their grandfather or something like that, who'd fought or been alive during the Second World War. But I had this very wonderful father who was incredibly open and honest about things, and had fought, all the way up through Africa, through Italy and up into Germany in the Second World War, and sort of told me, in the 70s, children of my age, we were very sort of obsessed with, I say in the book, we were kind of obsessed with war wars and Star Wars. You know, there was a lot of war imagery around. The movies were all about the Second World War, and boys sort of were given military toys. I mean, it's quite disturbing, really, when you think about it. It was we were given like toy soldiers and action men and things like that. And I was obsessed. I am happy to admit I was obsessed with war in childhood, absolutely obsessed with it. And I would ask my father to tell me stories over and over again. And my father didn't really bring up the goods because he was honest. My grandfather, who was also still alive, who I talk about in the book, which was not my father's father, but my mum's dad, he had fought in the First World War. And that my mother's parents lived in this pit village in Staffordshire, pretty much where they'd been born and grown up, very, very a coal mining area, and the potteries. And my grandfather had also been in the First World War and also been at the big battles, the Somme, Ypres, all of those big battles. And likewise, having failed to get the stories out of my father, I turned to my grandfather only to find that he would keep bursting into tears. Clearly had some kind of post-traumatic stress, even though he was then in his 80s. I mean, he died when he was about 93. And so I had a kind of cognitive dissonance. I had a disconnect between what my childhood imagery was telling me, the comics I was reading, the toys I was playing with, the films I was watching, and the reality of two central male figures in my life who had a very different experience that jarred with that reimagining of war. And I look around and I look on Twitter and things like that now, and I see that there are a lot of men in their 40s and 50s who are still in love with a sort of romantic notion of the Second World War. It's become a cottage industry. And I think, certainly the first two chapters of my book, I have for the last 20 years myself tried to come to terms with that. And my own sort of childhood passion and interest in war and the reality of what it was and all that that means from Brexit onwards, I think, is the long answer.
you're allowed long answers, Oscar. This is why we're here. but going back to what you said about when you started writing in 2010 about Brexit, especially Brexit was the tipping point for you. It made you quite angry.
Yeah.
I was just watching on BBC the other day, doing a documentary on David Cameron and his years in office. And the very first episode, I still remember watching it, and he talks about the referendum and Brexit. And when I was watching him, there was some element of humanity in him. You know, there was something made sense. Like, I understand why he even had the idea. I understand what he was going through. You know, the Conservatives came in after a long run of Labour leadership, and he was trying to figure things out. The question I have is that, how did this person come up with the idea of Brexit referendum? You know, it came on people's tongues after the crash of the euro. How did it turn into this almost well-oiled propaganda machine that we saw just sort of rise in the next few years? And this is what I'm trying to get my head around.
So they were always there. So I have another strand to my bow, which is my mother, who died last year. My mother worked in Parliament as a secretary all through the 60s before I was born. And then later on, when I was a teenager in the 80s, and actually carried on working in Parliament up until the 2000s, when David Cameron pitched up on the scene as a secretary. She was a secretary to members of Parliament, and she ran a charity. And so I kind of grew up around Parliament and the Conservative Party. My parents were both, my father was a councillor, my mother was a secretary to Conservative MPs. MPs would come to our house. That Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party was always there. It had been there since we went into the EEC in 1975. But my parents and most of the people they knew were not Eurosceptics. And the reason my father was not a Eurosceptic was because he had fought in the Second World War. it was as simple as that. My father loved Italy, loved Italian things, loved Europe, and most of all, did not want another war to happen. And having been born into the first one and then fought in the second, he was not exactly a passionate man, but he was very passionate on that subject. And he was not alone in that. That's why we joined the EEC. And this is one of the things that very much annoys me about the likes of Nigel Farage. The reason we joined the EEC, they discussed all that at the time. So back in 1975, when we had the referendum, all of that stuff was discussed. We don't want another war. We need to cooperate with our European partners. They even talked about a bigger Europe and a federal Europe. They discussed all of that in 1975. And the people who voted us in were people who remembered the actual Second World War. The people who pulled us out came from the generation beneath it, the likes of Bill Cash, people like that. Bill Cash, MP, has had a long-running personal vendetta against Europe. And I won't play amateur psychologist, but his father died before he met him during the war. And I think for people like Cash, who were not there, there was this sort of deep-rooted antipathy towards Europe, and a belief that we had lost something by going in, and that the grand empire or the Commonwealth or whatever had been diminished by our role as equal partners with our old enemy Germany and our older enemy France. And it's not rooted in reason. It's rooted in a purely romantic, mythological belief that Britain was once a great country, and that if we just reset the dials, we can get back to being that great country and have global influence again. I think it's as simple as that. It's what I call ladybird libertarianism in the book. It's a simplistic vision of the past. Cameron knew when he came back in 2015, because in 2010, of course, he was in the coalition with the Liberal Democrats. So when he came back in 2015, he knew that he would have to fight that battle again. It was a battle Thatcher had fought. It was a battle John Major had fought. This hardcore rump of Eurosceptics on his backbenches. And he knew he had to deal with it. And that's why he gambled the country on the EU referendum. Nobody talked about our membership of the EU in 2010. I mean, I think also austerity, which had come out of the 2008 financial crash, did genuinely make people feel who had less that there was a metropolitan elite who was benefiting. And I mean, the numbers don't always stack up on that, but we all kind of felt we witnessed it. And so did that really happen? Or, you know, there were definitely people within this country who felt marginalized, who felt that everybody else was having a good time. And so this is the sort of opening battle in the culture war, really, or the war of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's a bit, essentially, we've lived through a kind of civil war, but it's been an online political civil war, and it's one in which the people who have long been in power have managed to portray themselves as rebels and outsiders, and the sort of sensible people are the enemy. I mean, that's what's happened. So if you're a specialist or a scientist or a doctor or a historian or somebody with a bit of knowledge about something, you've kind of been portrayed as the enemy, and the populist mythos has become the sort of, if you don't believe in that, you're not a proper Briton and you don't really buy into this country or deserve to be part of it. That is really what we've lived through. But Cameron, I have to say, however well Cameron might have come across to people, in my opinion, David Cameron is the bad guy of the last 20 years. He literally, for his own political power, essentially, tore this country apart. It was the most ridiculously chaotic and dangerous thing to do, and I hope his name lives in infamy, to be honest. If he could hold the referendum, he assumed he could win it, and he assumed, because a year and a half before he had held the Scottish referendum on independence. Referendums are incredibly dangerous political tools, and that's why Britain hardly has ever used them in history, because it's such a gamble. I mean, if you're picking a flag, like, okay, so in Australia, about 4 or 5 years ago, they decided they would change the flag because it's got the Union Jack in the top left-hand corner. And so they held a referendum on it, and they put up like 4 or 5 designs, and then they all voted to keep the flag they already had, which I think is very funny. But actually, picking a flag, that's not life and death. It doesn't matter. It's just dressing, yeah? So for the dressings of democracy, I don't think it matters so much if you hold a referendum, a flag or a national anthem or something like that. But holding a referendum on such an immensely complicated issue as membership of the European Union was reckless in the extreme. David Cameron genuinely thought that people would that it wouldn't turn into something else, but he didn't take into account several things. Firstly, David Cameron was not that popular, and he certainly wasn't as popular in the country as Boris Johnson was. Secondly, he assumed that people would vote for the status quo, because people often do, but there was this undercurrent of discontent from the financial crisis. And thirdly, he didn't factor in the likes of Farage and the likes of Boris Johnson forming a sort of Praetorian guard against that turned in on him and brought the whole house tumbling down to meet their own ends. You know, you in a referendum, you just got to turn a few people in the middle and you've got it. And you've won, basically. And that's what happened.
I think there was a really bad sense of judgment from his end, because when he talks about it as well, he was hoping that, you know, Michael Gove would be on his side, and he was very confident that he'd be on his side to remain. And he turned his back on him. And even just a few hours before Boris Johnson went out to make his announcement that he's going to be to vote out of the EU, he was texting Cameron saying, I'm with you, I'm on your side. And he didn't know what to do. But obviously he made that decision because he knew that was his path to becoming prime minister.
Yes, yes. Oh, it's very Shakespearean, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, Boris Johnson calculated that he couldn't lose either way, right? Because either way, if Leave won, that was his ticket to Downing Street, yeah? But if Leave lost, it set him up essentially as the opposition within the party, and he knew he was more popular than Cameron, so he knew he couldn't. He knew he couldn't lose. You know, Boris Johnson has got the integrity of a hungry snake. You know, I mean, the guy is. the other trouble is that none of these people were risking themselves, because if you're very, very rich, it's not that much of a gamble. They were playing politics. They were playing Oxford Union politics with the lives of millions of people. And that's all they know. They've come up through Eton, both of those gentlemen. They've come up through Oxford, both of them. And then very quickly, they both ended up in the corridors of power. And, you know, the Parliament is essentially like a great big Eton. It's a big public school. It feels like a public school. It acts like a public school.
Well, yeah. I was going to... It brings me to my next question, actually, because I think about politics even when I was younger. And for me, it felt like a world that was so far away, I could never touch it. Like, it was something that was never going to be part of my life, part of my even part of my daily conversation. Just felt like something I couldn't even get involved in or put my foot in. And in your book, you mentioned that Winston Churchill was of the era where, or just before his era, where people became MPs because even they wouldn't get paid, but they would just do it as a side job. And it was just something that they would go into as a privilege. But now we can see a lot of, so for to put it very basically, we see women in Parliament, and they're using their voice to support us. And we're starting to see more and more people of colour in Parliament, and we're seeing this change. How important do you think this movement has been? And what do you see the country, you know, how do you see Britain in the next decade or so, seeing all these different people coming into Parliament?
So I think you need more of those, all of the above. I think you need more people of colour and race and different backgrounds. You need more women. You need a much more, you need much more visibility in that, and of class. There was a time when the Labour Party had a very large northern working class grouping within Parliament. You need more people from the regions, and you need less people, particularly in the upper tiers of the party, who've just had these very limited lives, you know, private school, Oxford and Cambridge, and then business, and then well, you know, they're all very wealthy. Well, the cabinet is a group of extremely wealthy individuals. Now, I'm not being anti-wealth, and I myself went to a public school. You know, I'm a privately school educated person. So I understand that background. It's, you don't pick your school or what you're born into, but we need a parliament that much more reflects our broader society. And that's bad in the House of Commons, but it's even worse in the House of Lords, you know, where you've got the sort of, I think the average, I do put it in the book, I think the average age of a peer is something like 73 or 4. I mean, my mother later in her life was working for two, in fact, she was working for Lord Mayhew and Geoffrey, and doing some work for Geoffrey Howe. Neither of them could operate a mobile phone or the internet, right? But they were voting on fairly significant legislation on things they didn't understand. Now, again, I would want a parliament that had members of the older community in it, but I don't want an upper house that just that has an average age of 73 of predominantly white men who are retired politicians or people who are put there through grace and favour or donations to a political party. So, in my opinion, the whole thing, and I don't want to sound like an anarchist, but the whole thing needs a massive, massive root and branch reform and change. If one good thing has come out of Brexit, it is that a big spotlight has been shone on that Hogwartian, rancid Westminster Parliament and the levers of power, and they can no longer blame Europe. They can no longer say, oh, it's an EU thing. They have to take account for themselves. So by taking back control, they have ended up having to make account for themselves. And I think what we've seen in the last few weeks with the Owen Paterson thing, how they tried to manoeuvre that in the most dreadful way in order to try and get him off. Or was there another motive, you know, which was that there's another person in the upper echelons of power who also has got some slightly questionable things going on, re-house renovations in Downing Street. And were they trying to set a precedent where maybe he could also get off because he's under an investigation from the same Standards Committee? So in answer to your question, none of that will happen in my lifetime, but I'm hoping my 14-year-old daughter will shake the country.
So Otto, just going back to what you were saying there, you really feel that we're a generation of shakers now, and you feel like change could happen. Yes, it might not happen in our lifetime, but there's we're in the positive direction. And I think that we're seeing that in currently in North Shropshire at the moment, where they've got this by another election to see who can replace Owen Paterson. And it seems like people are not interested in voting for the Conservative Party, despite voting for them for decades for some people.
So I think you've always got to be very wary of of a by-election. Yeah. I followed politics for ages. I started writing about politics within the last decade, and early on I was like, oh yes, yeah, here we go. And then you do become rather sort of jaded around it all. So there's lots of things going on in North Shropshire. So the Conservative candidate for one comes from Birmingham and doesn't seem to know much about the local area. Although Birmingham is only a hop and a jump and a skip from North Shropshire, but clearly people are very thinking very small areas in that region. Secondly, yes, there is definitely a potential working together of or people voting tactically, Labour voters voting tactically for the Lib Dem candidate. So those things are all good. I mean, one of the problems with our parliamentary system is that people continue to vote for people who don't stand a chance in hell of winning, you know. So you'll get the Greens, many Liberal Democrats and many people in the Labour Party are fairly similarly aligned, and in a broad church of centre-left or left-wing thinking. It is a broad church, but then the Labour Party was always a broad church. You know, it was always the Labour Party always had the sort of Corbynite tendency and then the sort of Blairites. And that goes back long before Tony Blair and Jeremy Corbyn. You had ex-communists who joined the Labour Party in the 1940s and 50s. So one of my continued frustrations with the centre and the left is that they don't join up and work together. Because if they did, which is basically what's happened with the right, you know, Boris Johnson has basically become the first UKIP prime minister. He's a populist figure like Farage. He's managed to draw those UKIP voters and disenchanted people into the broader Conservative Party. And in the process, he's put off a lot of what I would centrist Conservative voters who probably now would feel more comfortable in Labour or the Lib Dems or even the Greens in some cases. With First Past the Post, you can't, if you want to evince change, you can't be emotional about it. You can't go out and vote Green where only 900 people are going to vote Green, because you're not changing anything. And so a lot of people have got to, A, understand our parliamentary system, because I think genuinely a lot of people still don't get it.
I think it's made for that reason. I think people above in the parliamentary system don't want us to understand how, like, even the simplest things like taxes. That's why a lot of us just pay our taxes quietly, and we don't even bother to read up on it, because, I mean, it can be like quite complex for someone who's come into this country as a new person, just pay my taxes, be quiet, and that's it. And I think this is the issue, is that, I mean, now we're a bit lucky that we have access to the internet and people are good at like yourself. People are very good at explaining things and we can understand what's going on. But this was my issue when I was younger as well. Everything just seemed so complicated and complex and for the white man. Much, much easier to understand. So I really hope that, you know, people listen to this and understand what you're trying to say, because it's a very valid point.
It's incredibly important that people understand how First Past the Post works and how our parliamentary system works, because you're absolutely right. For decades, the two main parties have played to the advantage, the ignorance of the general population of how British politics works. And a lot of people just buy in, and people who become members of parliament, even, you know, I don't want to name names, but I've met some lovely members of parliament over the last few years, particularly Labour and Liberal Democrat people. Yeah, and there are good Conservative MPs too, with good intent, who want to make the country better. But once they're in, they kind of become part of the system, because that's how it's designed. It's designed to suck you in and to start calling people my right honourable friend. It's designed to make you part of the Hogwarts club of parliamentarians. It's designed like that. And that tradition stuff in Parliament is so far past its sell-by date. It just puts a lot of people off, and a lot of very clever people who just aren't particularly interested in politics don't understand it either. You know, I happen to live with one, my wife, you know, who is an extremely intelligent, very well educated professional person. But she's not particularly interested in politics unless she's voting or annoyed about someone like Boris Johnson. You know, that's common. There are very smart, well-educated people who don't understand it. So what help for everybody else?
Even as a doctor, sorry to interrupt you there, but even as a doctor, I was with the same train of thought that I was only angry at the discussions regarding abortion or the discussions regarding maternity leave. Then as a doctor, you start to realize, well, all the decisions they make in Parliament ultimately affect my patients. You know, doesn't matter what community they're from. And ultimately, it's, as a doctor, I have a duty to understand the system that we live in and the country that we live in. And I think now we're starting to realize that actually everything is a political issue. We never saw it through that lens until the last year. And this is why I think, yes, this last year, the last 18 months, last years have been terrible for the world in many ways. But I also think it's been really important. And it's like shaken us in such a way that we've woken up. It's definitely woken me up.
I always think, I have said for the last 4 or 5 years, Donald Trump and to some extent Boris Johnson were products of societies that felt they could shake things up and thought that it would be okay, because we've lived through so much peace in the United States and Western Europe that we've kind of forgotten what chaos is. And that's partly because the architects of the EC and the EU in Europe did a very good job. They did prevent further wars. They did imbue in people a sense of stability and safety, and that we were all kind of okay and everything was going to be all right. When I was campaigning for Remain in 2016 on the streets of Lewisham here, people kept going to me, oh, it'll all be all right. It'll all be fine. No, you do not know that. You cannot know that everything will be fine. And I did keep saying that to people. My point of reference then was the World War my father had fought in and the World Wars my grandfather's fought in. My point of reference now would be coronavirus. So we now know that you can't just take things for granted, that one of these events can come and interrupt your safe life, that voting for charlatans and clowns is all very well and good when the circus is running, but when there's a tornado heading towards the tent, you don't want those people in charge. And I do think that I think it's fascinating that Joe Biden won in America, because they basically, people reacted against Trump, but people also voted for a kind of safety. They voted for the sort of the gentle hand of the grandfather over the lunatic doing juggling tricks. And in the last few weeks, I mean, I'm not a member of any party, political party, whatever. I want this country to progress and to progress well. I felt that Starmer was fairly lackluster for the first however few months he was in. In the last few weeks, I've begun to wonder and allow myself to wonder whether Britain might go down a similar path and start to view Starmer, an intelligent, solid, safe pair of hands, as a sort of preferable option to the clown Boris Johnson. And certainly that's the game Labour are playing. So I think they're definitely, I really noticed it in the last 2 weeks. They are playing Starmer as that solid, safe option. You know, boring is good. Yeah. Boring's all right. Yeah.
Theatre we've had in the last 2 years. But I was meaning to ask you this right at the very start when you were talking about your book, Fake History. I wanted to ask you, why does Boris Johnson, I mean, you might not know the answer, but it's just something I was thinking, why does Boris Johnson have such an obsession with Winston Churchill? Because when he wrote his book on Winston Churchill and his life, you did mention in the book, there were a lot of things that weren't actually true. And I remember sitting in the car and telling my husband, and he was just like, I don't believe this. And I was like, this is all true. What's his obsession with Winston Churchill, and why is it that?
Okay, so I've written a lot about Boris Johnson over the last 4 years, a lot. I know a lot about, I could do, Boris Johnson could be my mastermind, and I think I would probably win the round, yeah? I've come to the conclusion that Boris Johnson is a man of singularly limited imagination. I mean, it's as simple as that. He does the same thing over and over again. And I think at some point in his life, in his chaotic childhood, actually, because we are all ultimately products of our childhood to some extent, I think he latched on to the myth of Winston Churchill and sort of perhaps even modelled himself a bit on it, you know, but not the real Winston Churchill. He latched himself on to the cartoonish Winston Churchill of the popular imagination, because one of the things I did whilst I was researching the book, and I became slightly obsessed with it, was this. I read Boris Johnson's book on Winston Churchill. I then found myself watching YouTube videos of him doing his promotional rounds in 2015. I went down quite a rabbit hole, I have to confess. It's fascinating. He went to America and he went to sort of big bookshops in New York, and then he trotted out the stories. He trotted out, and I've discovered this is what you do when you're promoting a book. You kind of trot out the same stories over and over again. You try out the ones you think people will like, and that's how you promote a book. So that's what he was doing. But it's very interesting, the stories he picked, because they were almost entirely the fictional ones. So he went on and on about Churchill at the front. It, you know, in 1916, after, sorry, 1915, after Gallipoli, the disaster in the Dardanelles, Churchill resigns from government and goes out and fights in the First World War. Now, I grew up with that story, and I remember watching someone talking about it 20 years ago and thinking, God, that's actually incredibly admirable. You know, he resigned, he'd made a mistake, people died, and he went out and fought in the First World War, an extraordinary thing to do. And I remember thinking for years, well into adulthood, that this was an extraordinary thing to do. Except that Winston Churchill was not the only politician at the front. So by the end of the First World War, about half the politicians in Parliament were fighting in the First World War. But I grew up believing it was just Winston Churchill. And clearly, Boris Johnson, we now know a bit about his research methods. He too believed that Winston Churchill was pretty much the only soldier at the front. And he came out with all these things which were easily disprovable. But because it was Boris Johnson, all the people in the audience, and I guess some of them pretty well-informed people, because if you're in a bookshop in New York, you're going to attract like local historians, and I mean, they're all nodding along. And that's very interesting. Yes, that's very interesting. Because, and this goes back to my theatre days, actually, it's status. If you put somebody with status in a room, people will nod along to them and go, oh, yes, that's very interesting. Yeah. So if it's the Prime Minister, if it's Bob from the corner of the street who's spent the last 20 years smoking fags and drinking pints of lager, no one will listen to it. But if that same person is the Member of Parliament, people will take an interest and think they have something powerful and interesting to say. And that was interesting to me, that Boris Johnson trotted out. He went to the annual Churchill Society conference and trotted out the story which I tell in the book about the cleaning lady again. So he trotted that story out over and over again. And that's why I picked on that story for the first chapter in the book, because it fascinated me that he kept repeating something which was such an easily disprovable lie, you know, a lie. It's completely made up. I think, from what I can gather, from what I've researched, basically he's been told it by one of Churchill's grandsons, and then probably over a big lunch, and then he's gone off and recited it into his book and told the story. And it's nonsense. It's clearly easily disprovable. The trouble is, that's fine if you're an end-of-peer comedian or some panellist on Have I Got News For You, but the man's the Prime Minister of the country, And he was then, at that time, the Mayor of London. And if you get somebody who lies so easily, who's so averse to truth, who's so uninterested in the actual history and is much more willing to buy into the mythology, and if in turn that person then creates a government of people who behave and think in a very similar manner, you're on a very dangerous path indeed. Because you just throw truth out the window. And there is a whole movement of those people, they call themselves the Common Sense Group in Parliament, who pretty much go along with this simplistic vision of the past. Yeah.
Because I think why see, especially in the last year or so, when we see our MPs come on TV, I don't see them as politicians. They're just actors. That's all they are. Mm. They're not coming on as the leaders of the people. They're coming on as actors. They've been given a script, and they speak. They recite their lines and they go home. And I think that's the danger, that these people in power, they're acting in front of the TV screens, and they've got no bloody clue what's going on. Mm. And I don't like to use the word propaganda, but that's what we're seeing in our country. And I say this.
Oh, it's totally propaganda.
And I say this because I remember last year, before I went out to protest, also my family were very against it at the very start. They were like, "Meenal, you're brown, you're South Asian, you're Indian. Mm. Someone's gonna say something to you. People are racist." There were even concerns that I'd get my British passport taken away from me. And at that time, I was like, "That's not gonna happen. That's crazy." Mm. And now we're seeing all of these things actually can become a reality. And my family in India were telling me that, you know, they were laughing at us. They were like, "You're supposed to be the top of the world. You guys should have everything in order." But people in India were laughing at us.
Well, rightly so. And why not? I mean, you know, Britain created itself as top dog and sold itself as top dog and created a whole load of myths around who we were. I often used to say this when I was doing teaching and training to people in the past. You know, the British, the English gentleman, you know, with his supposed sort of stiff upper lip and his decent manners and his sense of integrity and all of this kind of stuff, all of that falls apart when you actually study English history, where the English went around running the slave trade, taking control of India, playing people off against each other. You know, so all of that sort of charming, "Oh, how are you? Oh, how lovely." It all falls apart when you realise that the British created a fairly brutal empire that served a very small number of people's interests. It didn't serve the British people's interests. That's another myth about empire. People think it served Britain. It didn't serve Britain. It served a very small number of people in this country because, as I say in the book, at the same time that we were supposedly top dog, you had people on the streets of Staffordshire and Manchester with no shoes on their feet.
My dad always says, you know, Great Britain isn't as great as you think it is, because obviously he's read the stuff that you've read, and he always used to speak to us about it as kids. But I always had this vision of Great Britain because I grew up in Gibraltar, Otto. So for me, living in London and UK was something quite big, you know, that people have everything in order. There's equality, there's equity. But obviously all that went out the window when I came here and realized that actually racism exists. People, you know, people are poor here. Poverty does exist. And just yesterday I met a friend who'd come from Pakistan, and she's been here for a few months, and we saw some homeless people. And she said, "Meenal, the biggest shock to me coming to this country was that homeless people exist here." Mm-hmm. And this is the, you know, the vision that we portray to the world, that in fact we are great. But the reality is that this country has many flaws.
And was ever thus. You know, it was ever thus, you know. So I think addressing those bits in history, I mean, you put it much better than I could actually, but I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, I remember travelling around Southeast Asia in my late teens and early 20s, and I lived in Indonesia for a bit and with a family, and Arif, my friend, always used to say to me, "Oh, you know, there are no poor people in Britain." And he would refuse to believe that there were poor people in Britain. He just didn't believe it. And to some extent, he and his family were living a much better standard of living, apart from healthcare and things like that. But they were sort of, they were living a slightly better life than they would have done in the same positions in the UK, economically, if not in terms of healthcare and security. We do have to stop looking at this idealised vision of Britain, which never really existed.
I have a couple of questions for you. So you mentioned at the very start that your fascination for history and Great Britain came from your father and your grandfather. But what else spurs you on to keep coming out? And, you know, the articles you write are incredibly insightful. And the work that you do, I think, is important, not just for me, but even when I think about Radhika when she grows up, you know, this is the work I want to show her. What else spurs you on?
Success, for what it is worth, has come to me in middle age, and that spurs me on, because for a long time I wasn't successful. And so although I wrote plays in my 20s and they were produced and things like that, it didn't really happen for me. Weirdly, the moment I stopped trying, at the moment I started writing blogs and then articles and things like that, I found something I'd never really managed to get in my youth. I found my voice. And I found that Twitter was particularly good at it. I was particularly good. My voice suited Twitter because I said what I thought. And then I challenged people, and I wasn't really afraid of authority, and I wasn't really afraid of standing up to people. And so all of those things. So it kind of played to my strengths. I'm very lucky that I kind of built myself up from scratch again in my 40s, and that those things happened. So I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful that people, A, want me to write a book, and then I'm even more grateful when people read it. And I'm grateful in a way that I don't think I would have been grateful 20 odd years ago. And I'm also grateful that people seem to think I have something interesting and worth saying sometimes. And it's very humbling. Yeah. In addition to both of those things, I have had things that have happened to me in the last decade of my life, particularly my mother had Alzheimer's for 10 years. And I lost a friend, a very good friend of mine, about a decade ago to cancer. And both of those events spurred me on, because I realised that, in fact, my mother's Alzheimer's made me extremely angry. It made me angry with the government, made me angry with the lack of care. It made me angry with the entire system around later stage of life and all of those kinds of things. That spurred me on to write things. In fact, some people say the best things I've ever written were about my mother, which she would have found hilarious. She didn't know it was going on. So all the time I was writing things, even as I was writing my book, my mother just lay there staring at the ceiling. And I felt very spurned on and very passionate about that. And as I saw the Conservative Party rise that my mother dedicated her life to, and her own life going the other way, those things spurred me on and made me angry. Brexit has made me angry. Lots of things have made me angry. It doesn't mean I'm an angry person, but it does mean that I want my children to have a better world, and I don't want the mistakes we've made over this last decade to have further larger consequences. So I see myself as somebody who calls out the bullshit. And if that's my role in life, and I can do that for a few more years, then I'm very lucky.
Wow. That's very touching, Otto. And it's nice to see this emotional side of you as well. Because if you Google Otto English, it's all Boris Johnson and Brexit. And it's nice to see this emotional side.
My children don't like me talking about this, is because I get emotional and I tend to have a tendency to burst into tears. But my mother's story is definitely something I want to tell. And how I will tell that, I don't know. My mother only died last year, but it's a story I want to tell. And I also didn't realise until it was too late how much of a debt I owed her as a person, her sense of humour, her complete lack of airs and graces when it came to people. She didn't mind who you were. she talked to pretty much everybody the same and on a level. She was totally without class distinction or pretension. And the reason for that was she had come from a very poor background and ended up rubbing shoulders with lords and ladies, but she never really sort of, she never saw the people she'd grown up as any different to the lords and ladies, because of course they're not.
How can I read the work that you've written about your mother? Where can I find that?
Well, there's bits on, I don't know, there's bits on, I think I wrote a couple of things for, I'll send you a link.
Please do also. I'd love to read that and explore the different side of you. Well, Otto, your book Fake History is out now. It's on hardback, and I believe the paperback is coming out in a few months.
So the paperback is out in February in WH Smith's travel stores. They've got advanced deal on it. And then the paperback comes out in April. So and it's on Audible as well.
I think everybody should get their hands on this book, because it not only provides a perspective on what the world has seen, but it also gives us a bit of a lens to what we might see in the future as well. And I think that's really important. Well, thank you for your time, Otto.
Thank you for having me, Minna.
I haven't even opened my script. We've just spoken. And this is what I love about the podcast, that it's unscripted, unfiltered, and it was really nice to talk to you, Otto.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me again this week. And thank you, Otto, of course, for giving me your time and all your insights into everything that's happened. I love Otto's adjectives when he's describing our leaders and when he's describing Parliament. It's very poetic and it's very theatrical, and I absolutely love it. And I think I think that's what I loved about Fake History as well, is the way he spoke about the past in such a poetic way. It was very Shakespearean and very theatrical, and it was very entertaining, very entertaining read for sure. And make sure you do order this book on Amazon. The hardback is out. You can get the paperback. I think comes out in April. You can follow Otto on Twitter, where he thrashes the government just as much as he did on the podcast, and he does call out the bullshit quite a lot on Twitter as well, and that's why I just love this guy. He's also got a lot of content out on Byline as well, so if you head to the Byline Times website, which is also a newspaper, you can read a lot of his work from the pandemic and before that as well. He talks a lot about Brexit. He talks a lot about even our leaders who are in control at the moment, and his insights are very thought-provoking, and I really encourage you to read more of his work, and I'm sure you love him just as much as I do. He's also on quite a lot on Byline TV as well, so you can see him speak into the camera with more of these adjectives and speak into the camera in such a theatrical way as well, which I'm sure you'll all love. But thank you everybody for tuning in, and next week I've got another incredible guest. Thank you all for your positive messages and your positive reviews. It really does keep me going every week, and I love bringing these stories to you. I love talking to different people and bringing different perspectives and different ideas to your phone, I guess, or to your ears, to whatever, to your speakers, however you're listening to this. I hope you all have a lovely weekend, and I can't wait to see you all again next week.